call me Ishmael. With those words, millions of readers have been drawn into a story about a captain's revenge on a great white whale. Real quick survey. How many of you have heard of the English novel Paul Clifford? Anybody? You're familiar with Paul Clifford? How many of you have heard the words, "It was a dark and stormy night"? Paul Clifford, first line of the novel. So the very first sentence of a book, a story, has the power to draw us in or to completely shut us down in some cases. And this morning, as we begin a new story known as the Gospel of Luke, I want you to see that Luke chooses his very first sentence with incredible care. In fact, many who study these things actually say the first sentence of the Gospel of Luke is the best classical Greek sentence in the entire Bible. But Luke writes, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught." Now, that's a mouthful for one sentence. So let's break it down this morning. And I want to use this illustration this morning that when someone tells a story, whether it's a nonfiction story or a fiction story, in this case, Luke claims that it's nonfiction, what they're doing in essence is they're leading their readers on a journey. So they're introducing you to a time and a place. They're introducing you to a specific cast of characters, and they're inviting you to follow those characters on a journey, as it were, through the story and through specific events as they unfold. And that's kind of how I picture the Gospel of Luke. That Luke is inviting us to travel back in time to follow the life of just one man, a man named Jesus of Nazareth. Now, you may have already noticed that the subtitle I've chosen for this series is, "Who is this Jesus?" And I say, "Who is this Jesus?" because in the day that Jesus lived, Jesus was as common a name as John or David or Michael is today. But you notice that Luke will be interested in one particular Jesus, and his story is basically going to begin and end 24 chapters apart with people worshiping this particular Jesus. And in between, all along the way, Luke is going to show us this one man, Jesus, is the protagonist of my story. He's the hero. He's the central figure that we're following all throughout. Now, as we follow this Jesus for the next however long it takes us, we're going to be introduced to many characters. In fact, Luke actually is more drawn to individuals than any of the other gospel writers. So he's going to introduce us to people like Zechariah and Elizabeth, Mary and Joseph, Simeon, Anna, Mary and Martha, Zacchaeus, Cleopas, Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Susanna, and lots of other people, both named and unnamed. On this journey, we'll also see a very special place that Luke gives to those who live on the margins of Jewish society. Luke is more interested in the outcasts than were any other writers, and that's probably because he himself was a Greek. He himself was an outcast of Jewish society. So we're going to see particular attention he gives to people like women and children and Gentiles and lepers. He's going to give special attention to tax collectors. He's going to give special attention to the poor. And he's going to show us how Jesus interacts with these people that to a good common Jew, they didn't really even talk to these people if they didn't have to. Geographically, we're going to travel first from Bethlehem to Nazareth to Galilee. We're going to go even into Judea and Samaria. We're going to go back and forth to Jerusalem. We're going to end up in Jerusalem. There are all these different places that Luke will introduce us to. And there are also different themes. And a couple that I'm going to have you notice as we go through this is that Luke focuses more on the humanity of Jesus, and particularly his compassion, his love, than any other gospel writer. All right, so what I want you to do as we look at these first four verses, and you have them open in front of you, I want you to think of this as kind of a roadmap for the entire study of the Gospel of Luke that's going to follow, like a roadmap. So at the outset, Luke is showing us, number one, here's where I'm taking you. Number two, here's how I'm taking you there. Number three, here's why you should trust me to get you where I say I'm taking you. Okay? And what I want to do is I want to turn each of those into a question this morning. So if you're following along in your bulletins, you'll see these questions along with a main point. So the first question I have for Luke is, turning this around, I'm asking Luke, where are you taking us? So in other words, what is your purpose? What is your goal? What is your end destination? If I read your book and I understand it, where are we going to end up? And by the way, that's really important. It's really important when you start a trip to know where I'm going. You know, years ago, I was very new to Marty's whole life, my wife's life in Southern California. So we went out there one time. She had a business trip. She had to be in the office working. My daughter and I went to Magic Mountain and we played all day. And at the end of the day, she texts me. My wife texts me and says, okay, she says, meet at the Stonefire Grill in Santa Clarita. And I think, great. So I pull up my, you know, my cell phone. And I pull out my little app and I pull up Waze and I enter Stonefire Grill and it selects this address. And I'm like, great. And I just start following those turn by turn directions because I have no idea where Stonefire Grill is. So if you know Santa Clarita at all, it's like there are all these ranch roads and canyon roads. And so I'm driving for probably 30 minutes. And then finally I pull up in this one little neighborhood and Waze says, you have now reached your destination. And I look and I think, oh, no, I'm just in a residential area, like an old residential area with these ranch homes everywhere. And so I call Marty, or I think she actually called me at that time. And she said, you know, where are you? Everybody else is at the restaurant. We were meeting some of her extended family. Where are you? We're all here except for you and Maddie. And I said, well, I don't know where I am because Waze says I'm at Stonefire Grill, but I don't know this town. So I honestly have no idea where I am. And oh, by the way, I have 1% battery. So, and I don't remember, like she said, I'm going to leave and drive around and I'm just going to look for your rental car. And I don't even remember how that worked out. My point is, it's super important to know, where am I going to end up if I follow, if I track out this journey? And that's what Luke gives us in verse 4. So if you look at verse 4, he's basically saying, you know, why have I done all this research? Why am I writing this book? And he says, so that you, the reader, may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. And so that is a purpose statement. He's saying, this is where I'm taking you. I'm writing this so that. And then these things, or literally it's the word, the message you have been taught, is a reference to what? Well, the message in context that he's been taught is the message about Jesus. And he's saying, I want to write this book to give you certainty about the person and work of Jesus. So I land on this as our point one. There's your question one. Where are you taking us? If I read your book, if I follow this study, where are we going? And he says, here it is. Here's my purpose. I want to provide you with absolute certainty about the person and work of Jesus Christ. Now, you'll notice, too, in this first sentence that Luke is writing to someone named Theophilus. Now, that's a Greek name. It means simply lover of God or friend of God. And we don't know much besides that about this person that he's writing to, except it's clear from the context he's heard about Jesus before. Luke is writing to him now to say, I want to reinforce and confirm the truth that you've already heard. And I want to pause right there and say something important about that. Notice that Luke doesn't say to Theophilus, you should just believe everything you've heard about Jesus. You should just believe it. And you notice he doesn't say, you know, no one can really know for sure what religion or what faith system to follow. And I think that Jesus is as good a bet as anything. In other words, Luke is not saying, hey, just take this leap of faith kind of into the dark and hope that Jesus is the one that can actually catch you. In fact, he's saying the opposite. He's saying this isn't a blind leap of faith. He's saying, I'm going to give you something in this book that convinces you, that makes you absolutely certain concerning the things that you've already begun to believe about Jesus. All right. So if the destination that Luke is taking us to is certainty about Jesus, then question two, how, Luke, are you going to get us there? And we answer that question by looking at, well, what kind of book does Luke say that he's writing? And before I even get to that, I want to say, what kind of book does Luke say others before him have written? Okay, so look back at this at verse one, the who and the what. So he says the who is those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. So these are people who literally saw Jesus. They saw the things that he did. They heard the things that he said. And you were ministers of the word. In other words, then you passed those things on. You served other people by telling them what you saw, by telling them what you heard. Now, what are they passing on? He says, quote, a narrative of the things that had been accomplished among them. And by the way, note that word accomplished. It means fulfilled. So he's saying, as we talk about the life of Jesus and the different things that he did, the different things that he said, the things that happened to him, these are not just a hodgepodge of random events. You know, Jesus was this guy that just lived some random life of good deeds, good moral teaching before he stumbled and bumbled into Jerusalem and got himself killed. That's not the life of Jesus. What he's saying here by saying these things have been fulfilled is he's saying there was a purpose to the life of Jesus. And that purpose is he's come to fulfill everything the Old Testament said the Messiah would be and do. And he's fulfilling God's plan to rescue fallen people. So here's the picture. He says, I'm writing this book, and what I'm basing this book on is the fact that Jesus lived his life in plain sight. Okay? He didn't do this off in some corner of the world somewhere where no one could observe him. He did it in plain sight. He did it publicly. He said these things publicly. And some of the people who saw what he did, some of the people who heard what he said, they had different recollections. They had different memories. And I don't mean competing memories. I mean, they just didn't all see everything. And Luke comes along and he says, okay, so I learned this part of eyewitness testimony from you. I learned this part from you. And Luke says, I started putting it all together in one orderly arrangement. And that's what I say is Luke's product. So the book that we're going to read, how Luke is going to get us to this destination of certainty about Jesus, is he says, here's the kind of book I'm writing. It's an orderly record of eyewitness testimony. And this is what Luke is saying. I've taken all these memories, all these recollections, all these stories, all these anecdotes. And I decided, verse 3, I decided to write an orderly account for you. And again, it's good to remember the question that we're asking right now. We're asking Luke, how are you going to get us to this place of certainty about Jesus? And he says, because the only thing I'm going to write to you is the studied, researched compilation of eyewitness testimonies. Now, let that sink in, because whether you believe the Bible is God's word or not, and many of you do, but some of you don't, and you're still exploring that. How could a book be written by God, in a sense, if it's written by people? So whether you believe that's true or not, I want you to understand what Luke is claiming, that what we're about to read, these are not myths or legends or fairy tale stories. They're not even moral stories, as in, you know, the kind of story that you would read and you get to the end and they're like, okay, here's the moral of the story. You'll notice that this is not law. He's not just simply saying this is how you're supposed to live. This is not prophecy. This is not poetry. This is not even a how-to manual for how to do the Christian life. Now, as we read this, you're going to see that it's bits and pieces of some of these. You're going to learn a lot of practical things about following Jesus if you follow along in this series. But it's not primarily that. Because what Luke says is, first and foremost, I'm writing you history. I'm writing you things that actually happened. I'm writing you not, this is not Jesus telling you what to do for him. Primarily, this is Jesus telling you what he did for you, if that makes sense. And that's gospel. That's news. It's just a declaration of good news. Okay? So that's Luke's purpose. That's Luke's product. Now let's ask the third and final question of Luke that you have here. So we say, okay, you say you're taking us to this destination of certainty about Jesus, and the way that you're doing that is through these eyewitness testimonies. Okay, why should we trust you to get us there? I mean, anyone can claim that what they're writing down is eyewitness testimony. Anybody can claim that they've researched it empirically, scientifically, historically, and it's true. That doesn't necessarily make it true. So we're asking this question, why should we trust you to give us certainty about Jesus? And Luke must think that's a fair question because he answers it in his first sentence. Okay? Notice he says, I have followed all things closely for some time past. And I want to really drill into that phrase for a minute. Just spent some time this past week back at a family reunion. It was my parents' 50th in South Carolina. And they live on this little farm. My brother has a chicken coop. And sometimes the neighbor's dogs and coyotes. And last week, a big black rat snake gets into the chicken coop and eats all the eggs and eats all the chickens. And they start over. So I'm thinking this way. And this is just kind of what dawned on me about Why should we trust you to get us where we're going, Luke? Okay, so I want you to imagine that the chicken coop is yours. Okay, and you go in one day and you see just eggs just obliterated everywhere, just broken shells, stuff's leaked out. There's dead chickens, there's missing chickens, and you immediately march over to your neighbor's house and you accuse him very loudly. This was your labradoodle, Ripley. And he says, how do you know that? You say, well, I just know. You should just trust me that it was your labradoodle. He's like, well, I don't trust you. Did you see it? No, I didn't see it, but I just know. But let's change that illustration just a little bit. Let's say you walk into the chicken coop, you find the mess, the same mess, but you notice that on the chicken wire and those sharp ends of chicken wire, there are little tufts of labradoodle hair that have been caught there. And you notice that somewhere where he stuck his head in a little hole and tried to pull a chicken out, that an identification collar has pulled off and is laying there in the straw. And you pick it up and it says Ripley, and it has your neighbor's address and phone number on the little tag. Then furthermore, you notice that there's blood, like an animal's blood, in the straw because he's been cut on this chicken wire and he's been cut in some kind of big conflict that went down inside the chicken coop. And you step back outside and you immediately notice the first step out of the chicken coop, there are bloody labradoodle footprints in the snow, and they lead straight back to your neighbor's house. So you start following step by step back to your neighbor's house. When you cross over the street, you see, okay, there's the chain link fence. There's the gate standing wide open. There's Ripley right inside the chain link fence, lying down. He's tired. He's got dried egg yolk on his chest. He's got feathers hanging out of his mouth. Then you go to your neighbor and you say, your labradoodle ate my chickens and eggs. This is what Luke is saying. He's saying, I'm on to something because I've followed all things closely for some time past. Now, there's four things in that one statement that are very important. OK, number one, the word followed means followed the way you followed Ripley's footprints. It means tracked. It means investigated. It's that, you know, that kind of following. I see these tire tracks. I see these footprints. I'm following them. Yes, but not following them in the sense that I'm following Jesus, like just walking after him. But the investigative sort of following. That's what this specific word means. Okay, number one. Secondly, notice Luke says all things. And he's saying, I've investigated everything. I've left no stone unturned, is what he's saying. So as we pick up Luke and we start reading Luke, we're going to understand Luke hasn't just cherry picked some different interesting factoids and stories that he wants to communicate. He's saying, as comprehensively as possible, I'm telling you everything I know about Jesus. And by the way, that explains why over 30% of the Gospel of Luke is unique to Luke. In other words, 30% of what he says, no other gospel writer says. They don't tell that story about Jesus. They don't share that parable that Jesus told. Why? Because he's gone deeper into everything he can discover. Okay, so that's all things. Thirdly, notice he says, I followed all things closely. And that word's important too, because closely means carefully or literally accurately. What he's saying is, I want to make sure that my research into the Jesus story stands up to the closest scrutiny. I want to make sure I get it right the first time, because if you find one story in here, one word that isn't true, that I've misrepresented, it would cast doubt on the entire thing. And I'm not willing to do that when I'm talking about Jesus. And then the fourth thing, you see that he says, I've followed all things closely for some time past. And that translates a word that literally means for a long time or even from the beginning. And so what he's saying is, I didn't just show up in the neighbor's yard and say, well, I'm just going to start here. Ripley's to blame. He's saying, I started at the very beginning in the chicken coop where we had the mess. And I followed it all out. So when I get to the end of the story and I start drawing my conclusions about who Jesus is and what Jesus is worthy of, it's because I followed all things closely from the beginning. Make sense? That's the process. Put it that way. Luke's process. He's saying, why should you trust me to get you to this destination of certainty about Jesus? And again, whether you believe it or not, you could get to the point of certainty. OK, I believe these facts about Jesus. Am I willing to trust him? No, but at least I know that I have a certain record. And Luke says my process was a thorough personal investigation. And I shared this a long time ago when we went through the book of Acts, because Luke wrote the Gospel of Luke and also the book of Acts. But some of you may remember, or you may just know, that Luke was a physician. and Luke's personality, Luke's character, he was meticulous. He was precise. And that precision translated into his work as a historian. I mentioned this as well. Way back when we did Acts, there was this world famous secular historian and archaeologist by the name of Sir William Ramsay. And he actually read the book of Luke, read the book of Acts, and he said, there's no way this is true. And so he dedicated his life to going to the places that Luke talked about, digging them up archaeologically and proving that Luke had fabricated stuff to support a myth and get a new religion off the ground. He said, I traveled to the Holy Lands hoping to prove that the work of St. Luke was, quote, hopelessly inaccurate. And this is what he writes at the end of his life. He says, you may press the words of Luke in a degree beyond any other historians, and they stand the keenest scrutiny and the hardest treatment. You know, one of the greatest secular historians and archaeologists of all time, a man that's widely respected, universally respected by his peers, he actually became a Christian in large part because he discovered Luke is always right. Now, we know as Christians that in part, it's not just because of Luke's research. It's because God himself was inspiring those words, that God himself was breathing those words that Luke wrote. But he says, I never found an instance where Luke was even remotely off. So that's his process, this very careful, thorough personal investigation that's trustable, that's reliable. Now, why do I take all this time this morning? We're not even getting into this story, but I think this is very practical. That's your fourth point, Luke's practicality. I think this is very practical for both non-Christians who want to learn the truth about Jesus, again, whether you believe it or not, but who want to learn the truth. And it's incredibly practical for Christians. And let me show you a couple reasons why. So let me first talk to those of you this morning. You would self-identify by saying, I'm not a follower of Jesus. You know, maybe I'm here this morning because I'm just outright skeptical. I think you guys are crazy. Or maybe you're, you know, a little bit postured more like I'm open-minded. I'm exploring. I'm curious what you believe. Well, anywhere you are on that spectrum, you've probably heard that the Bible and these Gospels in particular are just piles and piles of myths and fairy tales and rules that nobody can keep. And I want you to see that if you come at this story fairly and with an open mind and accept that what Luke says this is, you say, okay, so maybe it's not a fairy tale. Maybe it's not just a list of rules to be a good human being. Maybe it's history. Maybe it's gospel. And you just come at it from that approach. You're giving God, you're giving Jesus a fair chance to make his case to you. And I think, you know, if you're not at the point of just like, I know I want to follow this Jesus, then maybe that's the best we can ask, is that you come at it with just an open mind saying, I accept this for what Luke says it is. Because that's how you would read any other book, right? You don't pick up an encyclopedia and say, where's the poetry here? I don't get it. You realize you're looking at articles, you know? You don't pick up Shel Silverstein and say, like, where's the information? It's just fun poetry. So read it as it is, okay? Now, let me talk to those of you who are followers of Jesus. You self-identify as followers of Christ, and that's most of you. And what I want to do here in closing is I want to tell you three things that I want to promise you that Luke is going to show you in this series, okay? Number one, or A, Luke will show you the nature of your faith. And I mean your faith system. Okay, this bears repeating over and over again. Let me read a quote from a historian and a writer. He says, Luke's gospel is not a testimony of his ideas or even of his faith. It narrates events that have been brought to completion among us. That is, the concrete and saving acts of God that have been fulfilled in Jesus Christ. The gospel is not a noble moral proclamation, nor can it be reduced to a set of abstract teachings and truths. It is not something that Luke or any witness can take credit for. The passive voice of the Greek verb translated the things that have been fulfilled means a history of what God has done, to which the proper human responses are belief and proclamation. The title of my message this morning is The World's Most Falsifiable Religion. And you may have seen that at the top of your notes, and some of you thought, oh, that's interesting. Or some of you thought, what in the world does that mean? Well, here's what it means. Do you know what the word falsifiable means? The word falsifiable simply means that there's an inherent possibility in what you're studying that it can be proven false. I'm not saying that it can be. I'm saying there's an inherent possibility that it can be. Therefore, it's falsifiable. Now, why do I say that Christianity is more falsifiable than any other religion? Well, just think about Eastern religions for a moment. Okay, so with an Eastern religion, basically what you have is just a philosophy where they're talking about, you know, the Eightfold Path of morality. They're talking about karma. They're talking about reincarnation. Is there any inherent possibility that you can prove Hinduism or Buddhism false? You really can't. You have to die and figure out, did this happen to me? And by then it's too late. So you really do kind of have to take a leap of faith. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, if I follow this, does it make me a kinder person? You could argue that it makes you a nicer person. But we're arguing, is it true or false? There's no way to even test, is this true or false? Because it's just a philosophy. So listen, if you were going to make up a new religion, which is what many people claim about Luke and his buddies, they're just first century. They wanted to be like the big wigs in a new religion. So they're just writing these stories and they're pretending to be these apostles. By the way, Luke never pretended to be an apostle. He's just a doctor and a historian. But if you were going to make up a new religion, you would never, no one would ever do what Luke did. And here's what I mean. Luke starts his whole thing basing it on recent public events that he's saying these are true. You wouldn't do that if those recent public events were false. Why? Because as soon as you start saying these things, a whole bunch of your peers would come forward and say, that's just simply not true. You know, you're saying that Jesus did this, but I was there and that's not what Jesus did. You're saying Jesus said this. You're saying Jesus died on a cross. You're saying you saw Jesus 3 days after he died and he's walking around risen from the dead. And you're saying 500 people saw that. And I'm saying that's a flat lie. Nobody ever saw that. Do you know no one ever came forward and said those kinds of things? You know, Christianity is falsifiable. You could easily come forward if these events are false and you could say they're false and I can prove it. But no one could do it. And at least one of the potential conclusions that you would be inclined to draw is, I can't falsify it because it's actually true. Let me show you a couple charts. And I did not make these up. Okay, I'm going to give full credit to this group called CredoHouse.org. Everybody see that okay? So this is talking about how other religions get started, okay? So you have somebody having a private dream about God, and they're just saying, you know, I was laying on my bed, I saw this vision, I decided to write about it. You have someone else saying, I had a private angelic encounter about God. You know, that's something that like Muhammad would say about the Quran. I had a private encounter with an angel. It's something Joseph Smith would say about the founding of Mormonism. I have this private idea about God. And those are like Eastern religions. I have this idea. I'm going to call it karma. And what they do with all these different private revelations, whether they actually happen or not, is they're taking that private thing and they're coming and that one person is saying, OK, now I'm telling you everything that I heard. And you can say, oh, I believe you. I believe that you actually talked to an angel. OK, fine. But can you falsify that? Can you prove that the angel didn't talk to him or her? Can you prove that the angel did talk to him or her? Christianity is different than every religion. This is how Christianity started. After a public ministry, Christ was killed publicly. Christ rose from a public tomb publicly. Christ publicly showed himself to the public, and the public told everyone what they saw. See the massive difference between those two things? And so I'm back to this point of why are we studying this book and what do we expect this book to do for us? Well, Luke is going to show you the nature of your faith. The nature of your faith is that this is not just real history, it's public history. It's stuff that everybody saw in his day. Maybe they had different interpretations of why Jesus was doing what he was doing, but nobody said, you're not healing the demon possessed, for example. You know, so the Pharisees hated him. So they had to bring this interpretation. Well, you're healing the demon possessed people because you yourself are a demon. And Jesus makes fun of them, says, well, that makes a ton of sense. So Satan's divided against Satan. And they're like, oh, yeah, that doesn't make much sense. We got to come up with another reason. So there are different explanations for why Jesus did what he did and what he said. But people were not arguing in his day, and we still shouldn't be arguing today, is this public ministry, public death, public resurrection, public appearances, the public, and that's who Luke is relying on. All these public eyewitnesses. And I go and talk to you, and I saw bits and pieces of this myself. I'm compiling an organized, mostly chronological narrative of these events, and I'm declaring it publicly. That's the nature of your faith. So the question, and this is important, the question as we come to the book of Luke is not, do I personally, subjectively agree with everything that Jesus says? You know, we're going to read some stuff in here that if you're tuned in, you're going to be like, I don't like what Jesus says there. I wouldn't have said it that way. You know, Jesus says things about sex and gender and money and sacrifice that they don't sound like how people are talking today. And you can say, I don't agree with that. But that's not the question. The question has nothing to do with, do I agree with it or do I disagree with it? The only question that matters is this true or is this false? Because if it's true, I got to take everything Jesus said and realize, okay, this is God. This is the Son of God talking to me. It doesn't matter if I agree with it or not. It's true. And therefore, I need to conform my will to His. If it's not true, friends, if it's not true, if Jesus is not who He said He was and He's not who Luke says He is, then it doesn't matter if you disagree with Him about everything, because He's just a guy and He has no power to do anything. What matters is this true or false? Let me say this too about the nature of our faith. Luke claims to give us a true and accurate picture of Jesus Christ. Okay, what we tend to do today, and I mean all of us, conservatives, liberals, progressives, Democrats, Republicans, men, women, people of different races and backgrounds and cultures, we all tend to kind of construct our own Jesus. And our own Jesus sounds a lot like our opinions. You know, you find your Jesus agreeing with you a lot. You're like, well, I know that Jesus would have said this. Why? Well, because that's what I believe. And we don't want to do that with Jesus. There's only one Jesus, and it's the factual, historic Jesus. And what we want to do through this series is just come to you and say, you're a real person. You're the real Son of God. We don't want some fanciful interpretation that sounds a lot like the best projection of ourselves. We want to hear from the real Jesus. So understand the nature of your faith, that this is God's revelation of true history, true good news concerning the person and work of Jesus. And our response to the nature of our faith is simply to believe it and to proclaim it. We're going to see that over and over again. Believe it and proclaim it. Luke will show you the nature of your faith. Secondly, Luke will show you the resilience of your faith. And I'm not asking for a show of hands here, but does anybody else here, do you ever have doubts or questions or concerns about either the gospel accounts of Jesus in particular or just something that you read in the Bible? And you're thinking, you know, based on what I'm going through in my life right now, or based on something I have gone through that was really painful, man, do I have a question about this? It just doesn't seem to square up in my mind that a God who is the kind of God that I read about Jesus, that this would have happened in my life or to my parents or to this friend of mine. It just doesn't seem to fit together. I've got doubts. And again, I'm not asking for a show of hands, but anybody else ever feel that? I've got doubts. I've got questions. I haven't figured this all out. This Gospel of Luke is for you, friends, because I would encourage you to believe that Luke probably had some of the same doubts and questions. I'm hearing these eyewitness stories. I'm comparing them with what other eyewitnesses. I'm comparing them with everything we know about archaeology and all these different disciplines. I'm finding it all true. And the more that Luke did that, the more bombproof his faith became. And he realized this is an inscrutable faith. There's nowhere you can come at this and pick it apart and say that's not true. There's no one who can falsify it, even though it's the most falsifiable religion. The Gospel of Luke is a demonstration of Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And notice Christian faith in that verse. It's the assurance. It's a conviction. It's not a blind leap into the abyss. How can we ever really know? He says, well, because your conviction is based on empirical, historic evidence that no one could ever refute. So this is a book, and I mean Luke in particular, but I mean the Bible, that can bear the closest scrutiny. And I want you to believe, even if you have your own personal wrestlings with it, how can that be true in light of this? You're holding a story that's robust, okay? You're holding a story. You can go as deep into as you want, and it's resilient. It can stand on its own because it's, one, the Word of God, and two, it's true. Finally, Luke shows us also the beauty of our faith. Many commentators will say that the key verse of Luke is Luke 19:10. For the Son of Man, that was Jesus' favorite name for himself, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. And so Luke is saying, I'm writing you a story, and it's not a fairy tale. It's a true story. It's a well-researched story. That's essentially a story about grace. Because what I'm telling you is that the Son of God became the Son of Man, and he sought out people that weren't seeking him. He came and pursued us. He was the one who was drawing close to us, even when we didn't know him, even when we didn't recognize him, even when we didn't honor him as God. And he says, and then he not only sought us, but he came to save the lost. He came to bring us in and make sure that we were safe. And friends, grace is beautiful. And if grace is not beautiful to you, it's because you don't think you need it. Because the moment you realize, I don't want what I deserve, I want grace. You know, a couple weeks ago, we were boating on our new boat, and I was like turning in one end of this lake that I'd never been on before. And Marty said, hey, these other boats are waving at you to slow down. And I was like, well, I'm going 10, so I think I'm fine, you know. And I circled around and went the opposite direction. And then all of a sudden she's like, oh, the warden boat is like chasing you with his lights and sirens going and stuff. And I pulled over and he's like, why are you going that fast? And I was like, well, because there's the no wake buoys there and there's the no wake buoys there. And I was in between them. So I was away from the shore. He's like, no, on this lake, you have to kind of connect a dotted line between those and pretend like that whole side of the lake is a no wake zone. And I was like, OK, I didn't know that. I'm sitting there knowing, OK, I deserve a ticket. I was creating a big wake and it was fun. I was enjoying creating a wake. That was doubly bad, right? I was sinning and I was enjoying it. And I knew in that moment, okay, so I deserve a ticket. And he went through a thing. Do you have life vests for your kids? That's good. Do you have this? Do you have this? Do you have a horn? Do you have a whistle? Do you have a right registration? And he's like, okay, I'm just going to let you off with a warning. Well, grace is beautiful when you realize I need grace. I need something that I don't deserve. And the more that we realize like the truth of this key verse and all these different stories that Luke is going to use to flesh this out for us, the Son of Man came to seek and save me when I wasn't looking for him and when I could have even deemed myself unsavable. So here's my very simple prayer. I'm praying that as we journey through this gospel of Luke, that number one, all of you get a better understanding of the person and the work of Jesus. And again, you can be a seasoned Christian and still say, I understand him better, you know, because it's like it's a relationship. It's not, if it were just data, you could memorize the data and say, OK, I've got it. But it's a relationship. So you can always be drawing closer and always be learning new things that you didn't know about your king before. But as your understanding grows, I want your confidence to grow. I want some of those doubts to kind of fade away. And you're like, you know what? I own this. This is my faith. And I see that it's reliable. I see that it's resilient. And I really trust this Jesus more than ever before, but I want to go beyond just trust and I want to leave you in awe. I want to leave you in awe. I want to leave you falling more in love with Jesus and realizing, look how compassionate he is. Look how kind he is. Look how there's never any word that ever came out of his mouth that you could turn over and say, here's a better way of saying that. That leaves us in awe of the things that he did, the things that he said, the things that he allowed to be done to him because it was for our good. So would you join me in praying that Lord, show us yourself, increase our faith, but also deepen and intensify our awe and our love for you. I'm going to do something a little different this morning. I'm actually going to read a prayer. This is from the 1662 Book of Common Prayer. But this was a prayer that historically the Orthodox Christian Church prayed over and over and over again, specifically toward Luke, and this is my closing prayer. So the worship team, you can come and get reset. This is my prayer. Almighty God, who called Luke the physician, whose praise is in the gospel, to be an evangelist and a physician of the soul, may it please thee that by the wholesome medicines of the doctrine delivered by him, by Luke, all the diseases of our souls may be healed through the merits of thy Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.